Today is June 24th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's escalating campaign to strangle Russian-occupied Crimea's logistics spine, the billion-dollar Rammstein aid package that's quietly rewriting European defense autonomy, and the fracturing seams in Western trade architecture as the USMCA deadline closes in. Just after 1 in the morning on June 21st, fires began lighting up satellite thermal sensors across the Kerch Strait region. What NASA's firm's data captured was not an accident. Ukraine executed a sequenced multi-axis strike package that began by blinding Russian air defenses, disabling 4 radar stations from S-400 anti-aircraft systems and 2 Pantsir platforms near the Crimean Bridge, before following-on strikes hit Port Kavkaz's maritime oil infrastructure on the Chushka Spit and the Kerch oil depot, including the Agaz Terminal liquefied gas complex. President Zelensky confirmed the operation publicly, crediting strikes at approximately 300 kilometers from the front line. By the end of that same day, Russia-installed Crimea Governor Sergei Aksinov had ordered civilian fuel rationing at gas stations across the peninsula, and Russia had suspended all ferry operations between Port Kavkaz and Kerch. The strategic calculus here is precise and deliberate. Former U.S. Army Europe Commander Lieutenant General Ben Hodges has described Ukraine's approach as a two-phase isolation campaign. First, sever Crimea's overland Jankoy Road and destroy the Kerch Bridge Corridor. Second, strike every documented Russian military position on the peninsula, until continued use as an operational base becomes logistically untenable. What the June 21st strike package demonstrates is phase one executed at a new level of operational sophistication. The sequencing matters enormously. Suppressing air defenses before striking logistics reflects a layered competency that was not consistently present in earlier Ukrainian strike campaigns. Ukraine's defense minister, Mykhailo Fedorov, has publicly described the effort as transforming Crimea into an island, deliberately withholding specifics to preserve operational surprise. Building on that, the ripple effects extend well beyond the peninsula itself. Russian forces currently pressing toward Zaporizhia City, per Putin's stated directive to capture it by summer's end, depend on supply chains routed through Crimea. According to RBC Ukraine, no notable Russian advances have been recorded in Zaporizhia, despite intensified assaults. That pattern is consistent with logistics degradation translating directly into operational stall. The shifting geography of power here is reinforced by 2 compounding pressures Russia cannot easily reverse. The first is the alternative route problem. Moscow's fallback overland corridor, running through Rostov-on-Don, Melitopol, and Mariupol, is itself under active Ukrainian drone interdiction. The degradation of ferry operations hasn't been absorbed by a resilient backup system. It's been transferred to an already stressed one. The second is the microchip constraint. A Ukrainian drone commander, identified in Euromaidan press as Charger of the 413th Unmanned Systems Regiment, put it plainly. There is no device where you feed it money, and it gives you a microchip that controls an anti-aircraft missile. Ukraine's Ministry of Finance has counted 1,437 Russian air defense systems destroyed across the duration of the war. That cumulative attrition is structurally difficult for Moscow to reverse under current export control and sanctions pressure. More importantly, this campaign has a historical precedent that clarifies what success could look like. Ukraine's own 2022 Kherson campaign followed identical operational logic. Sustained logistics strikes against Russian positions on the west bank of the Dnipro made retention of Kherson city untenable, producing Russian withdrawal without a decisive ground assault. General Hodges explicitly draws this parallel. The broader analogy is the U.S. Pacific island-hopping doctrine in the Second World War, bypassing heavily fortified Japanese positions by severing their logistics rather than paying the cost of direct assault against prepared defenses. The effectiveness was validated through compounding cumulative effect over time, not instant collapse. At Rammstein, something structurally significant happened that deserves more attention than it has received. The mid-June contact group meeting produced what Defense Minister Fedorov called likely one of the largest ever aid packages under the Pearl program, totaling $1 billion. The components are substantial. Belgium committed 7 F-16s, 3 combat-ready and 4 for parts cannibalization. The United Kingdom pledged £852 million drawn from frozen Russian sovereign assets, covering 150,000 Ukrainian-manufactured drones, 350 air defense missiles, and modern radar systems. Germany committed $600 million through Pearl, $400 million for air defense ammunition, and $200 million for PAC-3 interceptor missiles, plus delivery of another IRIS-T system and a, quote, three-digit number of air-to-air missiles from Bundeswehr stockpiles, confirmed by German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius. But the most structurally significant commitment came from the Netherlands. The Dutch government agreed to fund the manufacture and delivery of 700 Ruta cruise missiles through the Destinus facility on Dutch territory. The Ruta system exists in three configurations. Block 1, with roughly 300-kilometer range and a 150-kilogram payload. Block 2, with approximately 800-kilometer range and a 250-kilogram payload. And Block 3, with approximately 2,000-kilometer range and the same payload capacity, sufficient to reach Moscow-area targets. The specific block variants destined for Ukraine have not been publicly confirmed. The strategic calculus here is not about the missiles alone. Unlike prior aid transfers that drew down European deterrence inventories, this model funds new domestic production. It avoids depleting Dutch defensive capacity. It generates indigenous European cruise missile production capability. And critically, it does not require U.S. export authorization. That last point establishes a concrete, documented precedent for European strategic autonomy in high-end precision munitions, bypassing Washington's transfer approval mechanisms entirely. The United Kingdom's use of frozen Russian sovereign asset proceeds reinforces this direction, framing the aid as legally and morally self-financing, while operationalizing asset immobilization beyond rhetorical posturing. Germany's focus on PAC-3 interceptors directly addresses Ukraine's most acute vulnerability. The Institute for the Study of War assessed Ukraine's ballistic missile interception rate at only 17% compared to a 90% drone interception rate. Ballistic missiles are the critical gap. If PAC-3 and IRIS-T reinforcements move that 17% figure meaningfully upward, Russia's most strategically disruptive aerial weapon loses effectiveness, with cascading benefits for Ukrainian rear area logistics. By end of 2025, NATO members had pledged over $4 billion cumulatively to Pearl across multiple tranches. This single $1 billion injection represents a significant acceleration in cadence. While the Ukraine theater draws the sharpest strategic focus, the Western trading order is undergoing its own quiet fracturing, and the two dynamics are more connected than they appear. CSIS analysts Scott Miller and Bill Reinch have assessed the July 1st USMCA renewal deadline as likely to pass without formal agreement, formally triggering the agreement's built-in 10-year extended review process rather than immediate termination. President Trump, speaking on the margins of the G7 summit in France, said publicly, quote, I would rather not have the agreement, but I may sign it, and, quote, we may do better as a country if we don't have an agreement. Miller and Reinch read these as deliberate pre-deadline pressure tactics consistent with Trump's documented negotiating doctrine, not genuine exit intent. Negotiations are described as on track, but on a slower track than expected, with a possible resolution window in September or October, timed ahead of Canadian federal elections. Concurrently, the European Parliament ratified a bilateral industrial tariff deal under which European tariffs on U.S. industrial goods go to zero against a U.S. commitment to maintain tariffs at 15%, an asymmetric arrangement that European parliamentary actors are privately describing as an unequal treaty. The EU entered this agreement already carrying a pre-existing 10% tariff from prior Section 301 investigations. Agriculture is explicitly excluded. The embedded snapback provision allows EU exit if U.S. tariffs rise above 15% or steel and aluminum reductions fail to materialize, but that clause also signals how little institutional trust underpins the arrangement. The strategic calculus here carries alliance management risk that the trade arithmetic alone doesn't capture. As Reinch notes from direct interactions with European counterparts, interlocutors are asking why Trump treats allies worse than adversaries. That question has immediate resonance given the concurrent posture toward Russia in the Ukraine context. And the unequal treaty framing, even if analytically hyperbolic, signals depth of institutional resentment that will shape European willingness to cooperate on subsequent economic coercion instruments targeting China. Building on that, a specific episode in Canada illustrates the structural vulnerability in any Western-led economic containment architecture. Ottawa allowed a Chinese automobile quota at reduced tariffs, reportedly to resolve a canola and seed oil dispute, generating significant Washington concern over Chinese vehicle penetration of the North American market through the Canadian backdoor. Miller analytically infers that Tesla's Shanghai manufacturing operation and existing Canadian dealer network positions it as the probable primary beneficiary of that arrangement. Germany's dual exposure, dependency on Chinese production inputs and export market access simultaneously, creates structural drag on any unified EU-China containment response, even as Chancellor Scholz has taken a rhetorically harder line on Beijing. The Supreme Court's effective validation of broad executive Section 301 authority, declining to hear a challenge to the argument that presidents are limited to a single tranche of tariff additions without a new investigation, a position that failed at every appellate level, means the tariff instrument remains largely unconstrained by judicial review. The post-July 24th wave of Section 301 litigation anticipated when Section 122 tariffs expire will test whether this broad reading holds under second-term application. Stepping back, these three theaters, the Ukraine conflict, European defense autonomy, and Western trade architecture, are not merely parallel stories running simultaneously. They constitute a single structural moment in which the post-Cold War security and economic order is being renegotiated on multiple fronts at once. The Netherlands funding cruise missile production outside U.S. authorization chains, the U.K. drawing on frozen Russian assets, Germany accelerating PAC-3 deliveries, these are not just tactical decisions about this war. They are load-bearing precedents for what European strategic autonomy looks like in practice. And beneath all of this, Russia's domestic economic architecture is accumulating stress simultaneously. Russia's bond market recorded its single worst trading day since September 2022, declining 1.59% in a single session. Gazprom shares fell to levels last recorded in 2009. Russia's unemployment rate stands at approximately 2.1%, counterintuitively driving wage inflation in a war economy. The Russian government is reportedly planning an emergency fiscal injection of roughly $55 to $69 billion, described as approximately 40% above the original fiscal plan, while simultaneously exploring mechanisms to mobilize private citizens' savings accounts. ATM withdrawal limits and foreign currency access restrictions are already in place. Levada Center polling places Russian public support for peace negotiations at 62%. A separately cited leaked United Russia internal poll shows 60% of respondents wanting near-term resolution and 53% favoring peace talks. When Gennady Zyuganov, a Kremlin-aligned rubber-stamp opposition figure, publicly invokes a, quote, 1917 moment that carries analytical weight precisely because of his institutional function. His willingness to invoke revolutionary collapse signals either genuine elite alarm or a coordinated signal that elite tolerance for current trajectories has limits. For the next 48 hours, the single most consequential indicator to monitor is the Belarus targeting equipment ultimatum. President Zelensky issued a 7-day deadline demanding removal of Russian military targeting equipment from the Belarus-Ukraine border. Kremlin spokesman Peskov confirmed Lukashenko and Putin would discuss the matter. Whether Lukashenko complies, delays, or defies that deadline will signal Belarus's effective alignment posture and Moscow's willingness to absorb diplomatic costs to retain targeting infrastructure in the north. It will tell you whether the Belarus vector remains a dormant escalatory risk or is becoming an active pressure point on Ukraine's northern exposure. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.